This is Mac for Math This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up, talking tough on piracy.
The software piracy in China is a big problem. It's a massive market, lots of opportunities, and if the piracy levels could come down, the market, obviously, for legitimate sales would be tremendous.
We look at pirated Mac software in China and the never-ending battle to control it worldwide. Also ahead, two great shareware picks, including one that hits new depths.
Well, I think it's a very strong app, and I certainly recommend it to designers and photographers who very much like working around specific color schemes.
Craig Brunell on shareware and Q&A with Trevor Middleton, all coming up on Mac for Math This Week. And don't forget, Mac for Mat is the UK's number one Mac magazine. Each month, we bring you the best Mac hints and tips. For UK customers, you can subscribe to Mac for Mat by going to myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/MacForMat or by clicking on the enhanced podcast link now for more details. With the resources of Mac for Mat magazine, this is Mac for Mat This Week. I'm Brad Gibson. We finish our visit to China on this episode with a look at what continues to be one of the biggest issues facing the computer industry, software piracy. Nearly 40% of all software is pirated, meaning that the person using it either copied it illegally or bought it from an unauthorized dealer. That according to the Business Software Alliance, whose members include Microsoft, IBM, and Apple. Governments and software companies are making progress in stopping the illegal use of software products, but the problem remains a serious one in every part of the globe. The greatest challenge is in the world's fastest-growing markets, and no place is growing faster than China. Despite a worldwide economic slowdown, China's economy is expected to grow about 6% this year, and so will its problem of software piracy. The problem is so bad in China that much like the availability of pirated movies on the high street in the UK, illegally copied software, both Windows and Mac, is openly available for sale here. You might remember our last episode and our visit to the Fengshan Factory and Accessories Plaza in Shanghai, where we bought counterfeit USB flash drives. On a return visit, we look at the problem of software piracy firsthand. In the small kiosks that line this three-story retail market, there are few that don't have illegally copied software out in the open for sale. Simply ask, and ye shall find.
Hi, hey, Jen.
Can we get your Mac software?
For Apple.
Yeah, for Apple. Uh-huh, yeah. Great.
Hobbies.
Oh, wow, okay. Lots of stuff. QuickBooks, Roxio, VMware Fusion, Acrobat, Adobe, Fontfolio, Creative Suite 4, Office, Stuffa Deluxe, QuickTime Pro 7, Leopard 10.5, Norton Antivirus, Quark Express, Mac Life OA, GarageBand, Adobe Lightroom, Aperture, Final Cut Studio, Poser. Wow. And how much are they? How much? 45 RMB?
Yeah.
45 RMB is the equivalent of £4 or $6.
And these include the crack, the code.
Code inside.
Inside.
Oh, remember?
All right, so there's a bunch of them.
Yes.
There's five or six of them.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This is for VMware Fusion 2.0. All right.
Yeah.
All right. And you have the same cracks for all these too?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the inside.
Yeah, inside, right.
Mm-hmm.
Are these all pretty new?
Yeah.
Latest versions? They are.
New one.
We didn't buy any of the pirated Mac software, but we were able to snap photos of some of the products before we left, which you can see right now on our enhanced podcast. With no one stopping you from buying these hundreds of Mac titles at about the same price of a magazine, it's no wonder software piracy is so prevalent. And a recently released study shows the problem is getting worse, not better, increasing to 61% in the Asia-Pacific region, with losses reaching over £9.38 billion. So is the problem of software piracy so bad that it's impossible to get it back into the bottle, so to speak? Well, for answers, we turn to Jeff Hardy, Vice President and Asia-Pacific Regional Director for the Business Software Alliance based in Singapore. Mr. Hardy began with strong evidence of software piracy's real impact.
BSA uses IDC, a global research firm, to conduct annual software piracy rate study for us, and we just released the results of the sixth annual study. The rate that they found for 2008 in China was 80%. Now, this is a 2-point decline from last year and a 10-point decline over the last 5 years. So we've seen a reduction in software piracy in China, again, PC software piracy, but it's still a pervasive problem. China happens to be the second largest PC market in the world now. About 40 million PCs were shipped to China in 2008, and that's about nearly 40%, over 45% of all PCs going to Asia Pacific. So it's a huge market, second biggest to the U.S., and will likely exceed the U.S. even this year. So it's a massive market, lots of opportunities, and if the piracy levels could come down, the market, obviously, for legitimate sales would be tremendous.
With it being so easy to buy pirated software in a retail store in China, what does that say about the government's initiative to crack down or not crack down on piracy?
Well, we do believe that the government recognizes that it's in its interest to bring down PC software piracy levels to encourage innovation. China has a very aggressive policy to try and encourage indigenous innovation. It wants its software industry to be a world leader. And it recognizes that intellectual property protection is important. Now, having said that, it's not an easy problem to eliminate overnight. So the Chinese government is taking steps to improve its copyright legislation so you have the legal remedies to fight against software piracy. We use administrative remedies and civil remedies. The type of software piracy that's most prevalent in China and the biggest problem for us is the unlicensed use of software within businesses. Right now, it's not clear that this is a criminal violation in China, so that's a loophole in the legislation that we hope that they will close. But until then, we still need to rely on civil and administrative remedies. And also, the government has, from time to time, conducted raids on retail outlets that are selling counterfeit software. There are also regulations that on manufacture of optical discs. Optical disc plants are supposed to be registered. But the reality is enforcement is a challenge in China, and a lot more resources need to be devoted to effectively bring down the piracy levels to more reasonable levels.
Let me understand something you said a minute ago. You said that under the laws of China, software piracy is not illegal. Is that what you said?
No. What I meant is software piracy is illegal, but there are different types of software piracy. So there's the manufacture and sale of counterfeit software, and that would be a criminal violation. We could also take civil action against infringers and administrative action. But the use of unlicensed software within businesses, what we call corporate end-user piracy, that is not right now a criminal violation in China. So we use criminal penalties in many countries, most countries around the region, when we're taking action against piracy in the workplace. But in China, that legal remedy is not available to us right now. Although we're going to test the system, it doesn't look like that remedy is available. Instead, in China, we use administrative penalties. They have administrative authority to go into businesses if there's justified reason to suspect that a business is using illegal software. And the raids are conducted, and administrative penalties can be implemented. But this does not have the same deterrent value that, say, a criminal penalty would have.
If illegally copied software can be so easily bought in a store in China, what does that say about the BSA's initiative in China? I mean, I guess you would say you've got a long way to go.
Well, we do have a long way to go. Our focus is primarily on the use of unlicensed software within businesses. And the software could get to a business by employees going out to the retail outlets and buying counterfeit software. They might go to the internet and download illegal files using peer-to-peer services. They might buy some legal software, but then make unauthorized reproductions of the software, so it's an unlicensed software. So there's any number of ways to obtain illegal software. What we concentrate on is trying to get companies to do an inventory of their software to make sure that what they have installed on their PCs is actually backed up by licenses and managed properly. So it is a problem when retail outlets are openly selling illegal software. It makes it very easy to obtain.
We've been talking about China and Asia here, but software piracy is pretty rampant worldwide. I mean, it just seems the only difference between, say, the rest of the world and China is that you can actively buy pirated software on a physical disk. But is there any evidence that despite that being somewhat a difference, much of the piracy we're seeing starts in China and spreads around the world?
Well, China has been an exporter of pirated optical discs. That has been a problem. But the reality is pirated optical discs are pressed, manufactured in many, many countries. It's just that the profit margins are so high and the risks are considered to be relatively low. And so we've got a huge overcapacity in optical disc manufacturing, and a lot of the manufacturers turn to piracy. Also, the availability of counterfeit software at the retail level is certainly not unique to China. This is a problem that is pervasive in many parts of Asia, and I'm sure in Latin America, Eastern Europe as well. Oftentimes when you raid retail outlets, it's very difficult to get effective penalties against those outlets. Oftentimes you go into malls and the cover of a disc will be displayed, but the disc itself will not be inside the cover. The discs are stored off-site, and when somebody wants to buy it, the person will go to the storage area and then come back and insert the disc. So this just creates problems when you're raiding retail outlets oftentimes. And so we find it more effective to go after the businesses that are actually using the software. And again, whether it comes from illegal download, from unlicensed reproduction software program, or from installation of counterfeit disk, you know, it doesn't really matter how it gets there. We just try and go after the use.
You just said that you're going after many of the companies that are using the illegal software, but isn't that sort of like cutting off the head of the snake, but not the rest of the body, meaning the retailer who's selling it?
Well, you could draw that conclusion, but again, a lot of the problem is reproduction of what was originally legal software, but is only licensed for use on, you know, a certain number of machines. That's a big problem for us. Fighting retail piracy is a difficult challenge. The best thing is to try and stop the production at source. And this is why BSA has supported optical disc legislation in many countries. So requiring optical disc manufacturers to become licensed, to operate within certain regulations that require them to make sure that when they're taking an order that it's being placed by a copyright owner, to have to track the sales that they make and have reporting requirements, be open to inspection, it unannounced inspection by authorities anytime. If they are caught operating outside of the licensing guidelines, the license could be suspended or revoked. So we think that kind of regulation is important. But like any law, unless they're actively enforced, they're not particularly meaningful.
It seems that in China, piracy is an acceptable practice, and many say it's because wages are so much lower in China than in other Western countries where people take home bigger salaries. Does that not speak to the issue that many of the SBA's partners don't understand the Chinese market and are asking too much for their products?
Well, the price of software is oftentimes used as an excuse for piracy. The reality is software has many different price points. And we conduct investigations all around the world, and what we find is that the more expensive software is not necessarily more heavily pirated than the more inexpensive software, utility-type software. So we think that the driving force is not necessarily price. It's really just a matter of respect and attitude and approach. In the business, it's you know, corporate governance. What kind of messages is management sending to employees if they tolerate having basically stolen property being used as their productivity tool for themselves to create profits? It's a lack of respect for intellectual property. Of course, BSA is trying to appeal to management to recognize the value of software, and what the piracy rate studies show is that the piracy rate leads to direct losses to the industry, and this has an effect on jobs, it has effect on tax revenue, effect on economic activity. So what IDC has found is that the countries with the largest IT sectors as a percent of their GDP have lower software piracy rates. So for those governments like China and many other countries that want to promote their IT sectors, a very good way of doing this is to more effectively fight software piracy.
We have evidence that many major software manufacturers like Microsoft and Adobe have dramatically cut back on legitimate sales initiatives of their products in China simply because piracy is so pervasive and apparently so unstoppable. Does that not speak to how bad the problem really is and that your efforts to some extent are not working, at least yet?
Well, again, let me just remind you that China is the second biggest PC market. So last year, nearly 40 million PCs were shipped. And of those PCs, about 40% went to consumers. And consumers are traditionally a more difficult target audience to get your message to. And they're more likely to use pirated products than businesses, certainly the larger size businesses. The other aspect in China is that 24% of the PCs shipped were so-called white box PCs. So these are non-name brand PCs that are assembled locally, and oftentimes they come with illegal software installed. So this presents a problem. The Chinese government has done a reasonably good job encouraging businesses, enterprises, to use legal software, and because of that, those efforts with industry, we're seeing, I think, a reduction in the business level, but at the consumer level, it's driving up piracy. So on balance, to be able to bring down the piracy rate by 10 points over 5 years of the rapidly growing market, you can't say that's all bad. Now, the reality, though, is the market could be much, much better. With 40 million PCs, you would expect to have a very large size legitimate software market. China and Australia have roughly the same size market in legitimate software sales, and yet Australia is about one-ninth the size of the PC market of China. So if the piracy rate in China were like it is in Australia, you could have an industry that's nine times larger than what it is right now.
As you said, the majority of the sales of PCs in China are to consumers at this point. Jeff, you've got a tough job trying to sell this to consumers and getting the message out to consumers, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a challenging job reaching consumers, and we try and do that through our educational activities. We have a campaign called Before You Surf campaign that we've launched in China and other parts of the Asia-Pacific region. It's on our website. It's an internet-based campaign. And we try and expose parents, students, and teachers to cyber wellness, the do's and don'ts of the internet. And it's not just intellectual property we're looking at. We're looking at also other things, pornography and other things that of concern, Trojans that could be introduced, security risks and what have you. Our ultimate goal in this program is to encourage governments to put in the educational curriculum a course on cyber wellness. And our internet site actually has resources and a curriculum that teachers can use to teach a cyber wellness course. And we're hoping that ministries of education who have partnered with us actually in the release of these campaigns in certain countries, including China, will actually require schools to introduce these into their curriculum.
Final question for you. Do you really think the Chinese government really understands how critical and how pervasive software piracy is in China?
Well, I think the government doesn't necessarily agree with the data that IDC has come up with and its estimate of the PC software piracy level. They think that the piracy rate is considerably lower in China than IDC data would suggest. But I think there's no disagreement that software piracy, PC software piracy in China is a problem. There's no question that the government has strengthened legislation over time, has attempted to generate more public awareness about the need to respect intellectual property. I think there's been somewhat of reluctance to take active enforcement measures and actually penalize people who are caught using illegal software. I think they prefer to do it through an educational approach rather than a heavy hand, but enforcement is necessary. The other thing is, at the national level, the government can be saying the right thing and have the right intentions, but China is a very large country, and enforcement actions and educational activities are done at a local level. So BSA has extensive contacts with national copyright administrations in the different states and provinces, and we work directly with them. But we find that resources are a problem at the local level. to adequately get across the message and actually to take effective enforcement actions to the extent that really is necessary to tackle a problem as large as we have.
Jeff Hardy is Vice President and Asian Pacific Regional Director for the Business Software Alliance. We spoke to him from Singapore. An image browser and a Flickr client. Those are the shareware products we'll review for issue number 209 with Craig Grinnell, and he joins us now. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Brad.
Let's get right into it. Two great products this time. Deep, which is a tool for finding images or an image browser, and Flickery, a Flickr client. And let's begin with Deep version 1.1.0, £25 from Ironic Software, and you can get through it through our enhanced podcast link. In the last issue of Mac Format, Craig, you reviewed two other Ironic Software browsers, Yep for PDFs and Leap for general file browsing and tagging. So what does Deep do differently than those two applications?
Well, although Deep does have some similarities to those other applications that you mentioned, its main concern is in enabling you to rapidly rifle through all the images on your hard drive in the same way that kind of Yep is for PDFs. Mm-hmm. And it provides plenty of really handy ways for doing this, including filtering by location, file type, size, shape, and also color.
So you can browse all your images by color. So how does that work?
Well, when you first launch Deep, it starts building a palette database, and it goes through every single one of the images on your hard drive in turn, kind of rifles through it, sees what colors are in it. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a lot of images, that can take a while. On my Mac, I've got 60,000 images here, and it took about 75 minutes. However, once Deep is done, you can click on a palette, and loads and loads of palettes are actually shown at the top of Deep, and then it will provide all of the images underneath that it reckons are kind of similar. So you can select a single image, any image, whatever it is, and use that as the basis for a search. Now, this is really, really good for photographers and designers who want to find that right image to fit into a specific color scheme.
Right.
But I also find it really good if I lose an image. For example, I chucked at Deep a couple of low-res thumbnail images from one of my websites, and within seconds, it found the originals.
Well, very helpful indeed. How easy is Deep to use?
To be perfectly honest, the interface is a little bit odd. It's very different to any other type of browser you'll have seen, and part of that is due to the fact that it's got all of these palettes everywhere and the kind of filtering criteria that just don't exist in other applications. Also, it's very, very mouse-driven, which will kind of irk people who are used to the keyboard. However, once you get into it, it is pretty much simple enough. You're essentially just toggling different search terms, different types of filter to hone down your selection of images. Mm-hmm. And usually Deep is pretty intelligent in doing this. There's also one other thing I should mention, a really, really good full screen mode, and it's got single key shortcuts to all the important controls and even 9 slideshow speeds to get you through a whole selection of images. Also, like all of the other Ironic Software apps I've looked at, Deep comes with a succinct and really, really helpful manual.
Okay, now you rated Deep at 4 out of 5 stars. What was your thinking behind that score?
Well, I think it's a very strong app, and I certainly recommend it to designers and photographers who very much like working around specific color schemes. However, it's still probably a little bit niche, and I did have some reservations about certain aspects of the interface. However, there's strong attention to detail where it matters.
All right, 4 out of 5 stars for Deep version 1.1.0, £25 or about $34 from Ironic Software. Let's move on now to our second product, and that is Flickery. It's a desktop client for Leopard, and it's a Flickr client, version 1.0, £11 or about €15 from Eternal Storms. Flickery is a client, as we said, for the Flickr website. What does it enable you to do, Craig?
Well, once you've authorized it to work with your Flickr account, which is a straightforward process, you can use it to navigate your photos on Flickr, upload images to the website, and also to explore the entire Flickr site so you can perform searches or access to the Flickr streams of all your contacts.
Now, iPhoto 09 now includes Flickr support. So is something like Flickery really necessary at this point?
Well, I think iPhoto adding Flickr support was a much-needed thing, and I think it's great. But the thing is, it's also pretty basic in what it enables you to do. So you can upload some images, but you don't really have a great deal of control over what happens. Mm-hmm. Now, Flickery, in particular, provides a lot more control over metadata, and it also includes handy features such as grabbing the screen and then sending that to Flickr, all from within the app. Very, very simple process. Perhaps most importantly, importantly, though, iPhoto is really just for uploading, whereas Flickr provides the means to search the Flickr website, mm-hmm. add favorites, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and when it comes to standalone clients for websites, easy to use is really a must. So how does Flickr really perform there?
Overall, it's pretty good, I think. That UI has that sort of honed-down leopard look that all the other applications are trying to ape, you know, the whole iLife thing. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much idiot-proof in how it works. I mean, it's really, really simple. There are these bold icons and some pretty strong workflow models throughout. And it also enables you to save searches, which is really, really handy if you're a regular Flickr user.
Yeah. Sounds like a really great app. And so your rating, 3.5 out of 5, it's a bit of a surprise.
Well, there is one snag with Flickr, at least in the version that I tested. Unfortunately, it's got a lot of bugs. Now, there are various issues with the interface, including uploaded images permanently sort of floating above all of the others until we restarted the app. There are also some stability issues as well. So if Eternal Storm can fix those things, it's really got a winner on its hand. But I think I'd probably wait for an update before plonking down €15 on Flickr, or check to see if there's been an update since and see how well that works.
All right, so Flickr, 3.5 out of 5 stars, version 1.0 for about £11 from Eternal Storms, and you can get through it through the Enhanced Podcast link right now. Okay, so that's Deep and Flickery, our choices for shareware for this month. Craig, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next month.
Okay, see you next time.
Craig Grinnell reviews shareware for Mac Format Magazine. And don't forget, Mac Format is the UK's number one Mac magazine. Each month, we bring you the best Mac hints and tips. U.S. customers can subscribe to Mac Format now by going to myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/MacFormat or by clicking on the Enhanced Podcast link now and entering the promo code 2003. We think of him as sort of like your personal Mac fix-it man, but he doesn't do the dishes or walk your dog. He's Trevor Middleton, and he joins us each and every episode with questions and answers. Hello, Trevor.
I'm flummoxed by that one, Brad. You get more complex.
But you won't walk my dog, will you?
Well, given that you're in Tulsa and I'm in Derbyshire, that's a little bit difficult. But, you know, if you were a little closer, maybe I'd come around.
Right. Well, dishes I know you can do, so I might turn to you on that one. MacHelpMe@futurenet.co.uk is the email address if you have questions for us. Don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Question one comes to us from Walter Infeld, writing us from Holland. He wrote, I have a wireless home network which uses an 802.11n airport extreme base station with wired connections to a USB hard drive, his 20-inch iMac, and wireless connections to three other 802.11n airport express stations, if you can believe that. The setup works perfectly for streaming iTunes to all three express stations, and I can flawlessly access my USB hard drive over the network, he wrote. But I can't connect my MacBook to my Airport Extreme base station wirelessly. What's perplexing is that I can connect another 802.11g wireless router to the Airport Extreme with an Ethernet cable, and my MacBook finds it with no problems. It also has no problem connecting to hotspots when I'm away from home. So, what's wrong here, Trevor?
Okay, well, I think there's a clue here in the fact that Walter's MacBook can find that second 802.11g router, mm-hmm. and can also connect to Wi-Fi hotspots. Now, Wi-Fi hotspots have a huge range of compatibility with all the different types of Wi-Fi. Otherwise, well, they'd never make any money. Apple upgraded the spec of the MacBook's airport card from 802.11g to 802.11n around the time Walter bought his. So it's possible, just possible, he has one of the older spec ones. Now, the simplest way to find out whether he has is to launch Network Utility, which you'll find inside the Utilities folder, which in turn is inside the Applications folder on your Mac. Then choose the Info tab and the Network Interface EN1 from the pop-up menu. The information labeled Model will tell you whether your MacBook has an 802.11n card or is a slightly earlier model with that 802.11g airport card. If it's the latter, you'll have to use the airport utility to change your airport network to include compatibility with 802.11g cards. Also, there have been several updates both for the airport software in Leopard and the airport base station firmware, so Walter, check that everything's up to date there as well. Finally, check the level of security you've applied to your wireless network. if your Mac is one of those with the earlier spec, it might not be able to handle WPA PSK2 security, for instance. So try, if you have that enabled, to downgrade that to WPA PSK. Most Wi-Fi problems, in fact, Brad, usually boil down to standards compatibility or security issues. So, Walter, I suspect you'll start to find the answer there. Brad.
All right, question two from Simon Walden in Thailand's Gulf of Thailand. He wrote us, not all podcasts I download into my iMac are included under podcasts in iTunes. The Mac Format podcast ends up in my main iTunes music library. Now, this makes the podcast difficult to find. So how can I dictate that all podcasts downloaded go under podcasts? Trevor.
Well, technically speaking, a podcast is a combination of an audio or video file plus an RSS feed that iTunes usually recognizes as a podcast and then labels it as such. However, as we all know, technology isn't perfect, and sometimes podcasts can be miscategorized in your iTunes library. Now, the simplest way of changing those files into podcasts is to use one of Douglas Adams' Apple scripts for iTunes, which I've mentioned many, many times before, which you'll find at allthews.dougscripts.com. When you get there, take a look at the script called Re-Add Selected Tracks as Podcast, and that will do the job for you, Simon. Brad.
And our final question comes from Jim Ormiston, who's a regular listener in Cumberland, Scotland. He wrote us, every time I use a template in Pages, the address field, which is automatically filled in, needs editing before I finish and print. How can I change this to have the correct information every time, all the time? Also, how do I delete a free trial stationery pack from Equinox, which was installed in email?
Jim, like many other applications in Mac OS X, Pages takes your personal data from the address book database. So, simply editing the info in your address book entry will help. Pages also uses the field names that address book uses, home address, work address, and so on. So be careful not to add too many custom fields, which Pages might not recognize. And by the way, don't forget that you can save a Pages document as a template directly from the file menu in Pages. So once you've got that formatting exactly the way you like it, why not save your revised document as a custom template? Now, as to the stationery pack trial, Equinox tell you how to remove the paid-for version, but not the trial stationery. However, I've done a little playing myself, and you can do this manually. Once you've deleted the stationery pack software from your Applications folder, go to your Home folder, go to Library, Application Support, Mail, Stationery, and then look for the Equinox folder and delete it. Brad.
Mr. Middleton, thank you, thank you, thank you. Times three, basically.
Mr. Gibson, thank you.
All right, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Cheers, Brad.
You can always email us your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Jeff Hardy, Craig Grinnell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakularopoulou. You can always send us your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us for our next edition on Monday, the 15th of June. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.